Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Laurel K. Hamilton. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I am also an author of science fiction and fantasy. My most recent book from a major publisher is The Moonlit World, which is book three in my World Shapers series from Daw Books. My most recent book of any sort is Star Song, which is a young adult science fiction novel published by my own Shadowpaw Press. You can find that at shadowpawpress.com or anywhere that books are sold. However, my upcoming big project is actually an anthology connected to this podcast. Last year, I kickstarted Shapers of Worlds, which is an anthology featuring first-year guests of this podcast, and we're very close now to the release of Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which I kickstarted earlier this year, and which features guests who were on here during the second year of the podcast. And who are those guests? Well, there will be news stories from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kessler, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Schall, and me, plus reprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S. M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. And of course, among those authors are winners and nominees for every major award in the field and a number of international bestsellers as well. It's going to be a great anthology. It's all edited now, 140,000 words. I'm doing final proofreading at the moment, and the authors have the page proofs for their own final look at it. It is actually available for pre-order now. In ebook, pretty much any ebook store you would like to go to, you'll be able to find it. If you want an easy one-size-fits-all URL, if you go to books2, that's the numeral 2, books2read.com/shapersofworlds2, and again the numeral 2, shapersofworlds2, that will give you links to all of the, well, not all of them, but many of the places where you can pre-order the ebook, but certainly it's available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Indigo and Kobo and all of that sort of thing. It will be out on November 2nd. I'm hoping that the print version will become available at the same time. It might be delayed if I run into problems, but I'm expecting it to be available at the same time for print, and I hope to have both the trade paperback and a hardcover edition available for order. You can, of course, get Shapers of Worlds, the original anthology, right now in trade paperback, and on Amazon there's also a hardcover version of it. So please check out both of those, the one that's already out and the one that's about to come out. There's some really, really great stories in the new one. I can't wait to, as they keep saying, release it on the world, although that does sound a bit like a mad scientist. What else should I mention before we get on to this week's guest? I guess the only other thing that I should say, as I always do, is that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Other than that, I think that takes care of the preliminaries this week, so let's get on to this episode's guest, Laurel K. Hamilton. Laurel K. Hamilton is the author of the number one New York Times best-selling Anita Blake Vampire Hunter series and the Mary Gentry Fay Detective series. With more than 40 novels published and 20 million books sold, but who's counting? Laurel continues to create groundbreaking fiction inspired by her lifelong love of monster movies, ghost stories, mythology, folklore, and things that go bump in the night. She lives in St. Louis with her family, and in her free time, Laurel trains in Filipino martial arts with a specialization in blade work. Laurel, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you for having me here.
I was just saying before we started that I try to find connections with my, and I have two with you, actually. I have been to Heber Springs, Arkansas. Not everybody can say that.
That is true.
Which is where you were born. I know. Yes. You didn't grow up in Arkansas. And I went to university in Arkansas at Harding University in Searcy, Arkansas. We actually, I think I sang in my choir at Heber Springs at the, I think that's where the big fish fry was, if I remember right.
I actually have family that when you ask where they're from, they say, they're from Searcy, and most people, you have to say what mountain it's over or something to find it.
Petit Jean Mountain is in that area as well. That's what's and then the other very slight connection is I think we were both at Dragon Con at the same time, and I saw you in the distance, so there you go.
That is such a huge event.
Yeah, it was the only time I've ever been. It was in 2018, and it was a little big for my taste. I kind of prefer smaller conventions when I go to things like that, but it was certainly an experience.
I really like Dragon Con, but if you have problems with crowds, perhaps not.
Well, I remember shuffling along over one of the walkways with all these people and remembering the scene in the Star Trek episode where there's actually an overpopulated planet outside this fake Enterprise that has been created. And when he finally sees outside, it's all these people shoulder to shoulder shuffling along. And I thought, hey, I'm in that episode. Well, anyway, that's enough about that. Let's get on to talking about you. I'm going to start, as I always do, by taking you back into the mists of time and find out we talked where you were born, but, you know, where you grew up, how you got started. We usually start as readers, how you got started interested in writing as a youngster. And, you know, tell me your life story.
Well, I actually didn't read early. A lot of writers read early, but I didn't. I was 7 before I could read. And I still remember, I grew up with my grandmother reading to me. I mean, that was one thing that we shared, that she was always a reader, and so she would read to me. But at 7, I still remember getting off the school bus, and as soon as I got off, I was yelling at the top of my lungs, "Granny, I can read, I can read, I can read." I would later be diagnosed with dyslexia in my 40s, and it went undiagnosed. By that time, I had 2 college degrees and was a best-selling novelist, and no one caught it. I was diagnosed when my daughter was diagnosed. So the reason I couldn't read until I was 7 was that. But once I could, oh my God, I totally exceeded my age level and read things, anything and everything. It was like the world opened up. I still remember, because how frustrating it was to not be able to read, how the world changed and opened up for me, that I could read on my own and not have to wait for somebody to read to me. And from the moment that, you know, from the moment I had somebody read to me, from the moment that stories first came to me and I read other people's stories, it was magical. I started at 12 and a half. I finally set pen to paper and tried to write, but my first few attempts were Louisa May Alcott, Little Women imitations.
I read Little Women.
Yes. It would take me years to realize I read a abridged version that they took out all the suffragette stuff.
No.
but Louisa May Alcott actually supported her entire family, her extended family, by her writing, and it was a woman that did that in the 1800s. This is unheard of. So one of the reasons that she was one of my early writing heroes was that she was a woman and she had supported her family at it. So that was my first attempt at writing, and I never finished anything. It just didn't work. And then when I was 13 or 14, I was in the drugstore where they used to have the book, the little metal shelves of books that went around, not, you know.
Yes.
And there was a short story collection called Pigeons from Hell by Robert E. Howard. And it was the first dark fantasy, first heroic fantasy that I had ever read. And from the moment I read that, I realized that not only did I want to be a writer, but I wanted to be this kind of writer. Pigeons from Hell. And it's his anthology of dark fantasy and horror and heroic fantasy. And that was the game changer for me. And so after I read that and realized I wanted to write this, I finished my first story at 14, beginning to end. Not very good, but it was horror and everybody died at the end. And after that, I started writing regularly. And I was really blessed. I had some wonderful teachers in high school.
That was my next question.
I had some wonderful teachers in high school. Miss Sheline, she taught beginning writing. introduction to writing, creative writing, that you usually have freshman or sophomore year. And I gave her my very first vampire story. I submitted it. And she wrote on the paper that I had scared her. And as a very shy 14-year-old raised in the middle of farm country in Indiana, the fact that I scared an adult, I remember just being giddy about that. And I thought, yes, this is what I want to do. And then I had another teacher whose name is escaping me. Nope, it's gone. Gone to the field of, you know, lost socks, as we say. But she had gotten out of a library, was giving away their copies of The Writer and Writer's Digest, getting rid of them for like a penny a copy. And she gave me an armload of them. Now, in retrospect, years later, I realized that she might have meant for me to keep them and bring them back. But I thought she gave them to me. Maybe she did, because she never asked for them back. I don't know if she meant for me to take them or if she really didn't have the heart to ask for them back. But either way, I read those magazines, and that's how I learned to submit in a professional manner. By age 17, I was submitting stories to magazines for publication. I even got some handwritten notes saying, you know, try us again, which at that time I didn't realize how positive that was. Had I understood that, I might have been published earlier. But so then college came, and I went into college for writing. That's what I was going to get my degree in writing, English lit. Then my idea was go ahead and get my doctorate in English literature and teach and then write at the same time. But I was raised by my grandmother after my mother's death. And so my grandmother wanted me to stay home. The only place close enough to go to college and stay home was a small Christian college. And I submitted to the writing program a vampire story and a Lovecraftian pastiche. And they accepted me. They accepted me in the program. It's not like I hid what I was going to write. What I did not know is the head of the writing program accepted me with this idea that she could cure me of wanting to write this kind of stuff.
Oh, dear. I'm glad she didn't.
well, me too, but she gave it a good try. Sophomore year, I tested out a lot of early English, and so I was in an upper level class writing class by sophomore year, and she was tired of me not taking the hint, so she just announced to the class that John would no longer be accepted for writing assignments. It was all garbage. I raised my hand, and by that time in the semester, she must have dreaded me raising my hand. Because I persisted in writing genre, by that time, half the class had joined my little rebellion, and one person was writing a Western, one person was writing a mystery, one person was writing romance, another person was writing fantasy. You know, half the class was writing genre because I refused to stop. So one day she pronounced it all garbage, and I raised my hand. And I said, well, I said, it's a small Christian college. So I thought, okay, so C.S. Lewis and Narnia and his science fiction novels, are they garbage? And she says, well, no, C.S. Lewis is not garbage. I said, okay, how about Tolkien? She says, no, Tolkien's okay too. I said, okay, how about Shakespeare? And she says, what about Shakespeare? And I says, well, Macbeth has the witches. You have the ghost in Hamlet. And Midsummer Night's Dream is all about the fairies and mythology. And she gave me Shakespeare. I said, well, what about Dickens? I said, A Christmas Story is just a ghost story. She gave me that. And then it's me, so I pushed it. And I said, and Moby Dick is just a monster movie. And she told me to shut up and sit down. She would, a couple of days later, call me into her office and talk to me for at least 2 hours. It felt longer. And she did her best to make sure I would never write again. She sliced me, diced me, served me on toast, told me that I would never write, told me I should give up, told me that my dream, my lifetime's dream, would never happen. And she did her best to make sure I would never write again. And I didn't. I didn't write for 2 years. And I think next day or the day after, I actually went to the biology department because my two great loves, have always been biology and writing. I went to the biology department. I said, I have two more years and I have to get my degree. And this is what's happened with my writing. The head of the writing department kicked me out. And I said, I need to finish my degree. And bless his heart, he helped me test out of 2 years of biology. And I got my degree of biology and finished out my English with English literature and stopped taking the writing classes in 4 years. And I didn't know if I'd ever write again.
You know, I always ask authors who've had formal writing classes if they were helpful or not, but I think that's the worst version of no, they weren't, that I've ever heard from an author.
And people, you know, people say, I would not write again. I would not pick up pen to paper. I mean, I've had a writer's notebook, a spiral-bound writer's notebook, the same kind of steno notebook. I have had one of those since I was at least 14. I have written in that for ever. I would not even do that for 2 years after she did that. And we graduated. I ended up moving to Los Angeles for a few years. And it was there, you know, I would finally begin to write again. But people say, well, have I sent her my books and shown how successful I am? And she was wrong. And I said, you don't understand. She didn't think I couldn't write. She thought I couldn't, I wasn't going to write what she wanted me to write. And she literally told me, she was kicking me out of the program because I was a corrupting influence on the other students. And I said, you know, to people say, oh, you should send her books. I said, no, you don't understand. I have gone out and done exactly what she feared I would do. I've gone out to corrupt millions. No, I am not a fan of formal writing classes because of that, because I just can't. It was evil. It was literally evil. She knew it was wrong. How could you not, as a teacher, decide what somebody should write and what they shouldn't? And how dare you try to crush their muse and their stories like that?
That's a kind of a horror and monster story right there, just with her as the
monster. Absolutely. But I would start. And, you know, political things aside, Writers of the Future contest, it was every 6 weeks. And I began to use that as my goal. I would write a story every 6 weeks to submit. And for me as a writer, deadlines are very important to me. They help me. I need to know I have a finite amount of time to write. It helps spur me. It helps me figure out my timing. So I never won. I never even came as a runner-up. But it was very important to have that every 6 weeks a story, every 6 weeks a story. And I was working in corporate America by then and hating it. But I found that I could not write at the end of the day. I was so drained from being in the cube farm that I could not write at the end of the day. So I would get up at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and at that time I was not a morning writer. I would get up at 5 a.m. and write for a couple of hours before I had to get ready for work, because I think that because that was the only time I had, and that helped me not have time to edit. The most important thing I learned is that I would print out all my pages, so that at the end of the day, so I could see it starting to become a book, because the accumulation of pages, the physical accumulation, let me know it looked more and more like a book. And because I had so little time, I couldn't sit there and agonize over it. So I would write my 2 to 4 pages a day, and I would not edit as I went. No editing. It helped that at that time, in the 80s, I would have had to go to the library to edit. Now, with online, it's so easy to go down the rabbit hole of research. Mm. So I still to this day do not edit in first draft, especially if I'm having problems. I do not edit in first draft. If I have a research question that I don't know already, I sit there and go in big bold letters, you know, what does 15th century underwear look like? You know, I'm just getting them dressed or undressed. It doesn't matter, really. Or what food would they eat here? Or I don't remember the name of that particular martial arts move, and you just write it in bold. And then I choose a word that is not in the book. I choose a word that will that is not in the book, that will never be in a book, like rutabaga or hippopotamus, something. Every writer chooses their own word that's not going to be in the book. And that way, when you have that first draft done, second draft, I just go through and look for that word. I go through and look for the word and fill in my research, fill in the thoughts I couldn't remember. And that is second draft. Third draft is when you start polishing the writing, for me.
Well, this is getting into what we'll talk about a little bit later with your process. Where in all that did you start selling?
I had part of my first novel, Nightseer, done. When I was working at Xerox back in the day, and it was just before they had the big downsizing, and I ended up being downsized. So my first husband, who I was married to at the time, said, since I had part of my novel done, he said, well, take the time, finish your novel, see if it sells before you look for a job. And I was lucky enough that he had a job that we could do that. And my first novel sold, which is really unusual. Most people don't understand that these overnight successes, the fact that the first novel I ever wrote sold is what's unusual.
I understand.
I knew you would. Nightseer is very elves, dwarves, and dragons. It is Robert E. Howard's, Conan meets Tolkien. It's kind of a mix. And I'm still happy with the novel. It was supposed to be one of four, supposed to be a series. And now, by the time I finished it, we had moved to St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I've been since then. And I finished it, and it sold. Miracle of miracles. I managed to get an agent, and it sold. So I will add that part. I did have an agent that was marketing it for me. And so it sold, but like most first novels, it didn't sell very well. And when I wrote the second one, they didn't want it. My editor said it lacked a certain je ne sais quoi, which is French for that certain something. So there was not even anything to do editorially. He just said no. I had one book out. I thought my career might be over. I was in a panic. My agent at the time was able to get me a Star Trek. I did a Next Generation Star Trek book. And then I looked through my short stories that had not sold. And I thought, is there anything in there that could be a book? And I had a short story called Those Who Seek Forgiveness that I'd had the best rejection letters on. But nobody knew what to do with it. And in fact, one person had said one of my stories was so good, but my name wasn't enough to sell and put on the front of their magazine. It wouldn't sell copies. So I thought, you know, I really like this story, and has this character, Anita Black at the time was her last name, and I would later change it to Blake, and I wrote a book. I started writing a book in that world. I would go to my very first science fiction and fantasy convention. I'm sorry, I'm hitting my timeline in my head. No, I take it back. I think this is important to know because I do want to say it, but actually I didn't have my agent at the time that I went to this convention. So I've got my timeline out of it. But I would like other writers to know that the best thing they had a writer's workshop, and Emma Bull and Will Shetterly and Stephen Gould were teaching it. And I put through one of the drafts of my first novel, Nightseer, and I also put the short story, Those Who Seek Forgiveness. They liked Nightseer well enough, but they really thought something special. They said the short story was so unique they'd never seen anything like it. And I would sell the next story after that workshop. It didn't teach me to be a better writer. It taught me to be a better editor of my own work. That was what it taught me. And the story that I wrote after that workshop sold. It was my first sale. And to Marion Zimmer Bradley's Fantasy Magazine, which is, of course, defunct like so many magazines now.
I remember that one.
And but that workshop taught me to be a better editor. It would also be that I would meet the beginning members of our writing group that I'm still a member of. And then the next science fiction fantasy convention that I went to was where I met my agent, because that by that time my book was ready to go. And when I talked, she was on a panel. I went up to her and talked to her and I said, I have a book. Could I send it to you? And she said, how many drafts have you done? And I said, 7. And she says, okay, send it to me. I went home and did another draft, and then I sent it to her. She would say later that if I had not said 7 drafts or multiple drafts, she would have said no. She wouldn't have even looked at it. And she would then send the book out, and it would sell, but not well enough. So I went back to that short story that everyone liked, but nobody knew what to do with, and I wrote a book called Guilty Pleasures. And it was so different. At that time, this is the late 80s. I mean, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer hadn't even been on. So, you know, this was so different. I didn't know if it would work or not. I thought, am I wasting my time here? And at the science fiction convention that next year, I ended up reading. I got a reading for the first time. And as a new writer, you go read and nobody comes to your readings. They really don't. They don't know who you are. They don't really care. It's very demoralizing usually.
Oh, yes, it is.
you know, we've all done our early signings where, you know, if you dress in a little suit skirt, they think you work at the bookstore. And they keep asking where the baseball card books are. But I had a room and I sat down and the room filled up. The room filled up, standing room, and I thought, what is going on? And I was so new, I didn't realize how unusual this was. And I read them, the first 70 pages of Guilty Pleasures. And when I got done, there was silence in the room. I thought, oh God, they hate it. And then they applauded, they were wild, and just, oh my God, where's the rest? And what I didn't tell anybody in the room is that there was no more. I had read them everything I had. But their reaction helped buoy me and go, no, I am right. This is good. I learned later the reason I had an audience was that Melinda Snodgrass, who was writing on Star Trek Next Generation, was supposed to have a reading in that room. But she canceled. And nobody knew what Melinda Snodgrass looked like. So when they came into the room and saw me, they thought I was her. That is why I had an audience for that reading.
Well, it certainly worked out for you.
It really did. It really did. And when I sold Guilty Pleasures, it was a 3-book deal. I had a contract for 3 books. And I remember very clearly thinking, well, at least there'll be 3 of them.
And how many have there been now?
28.
Well, that's, like I said, that certainly worked out for you. It's been, you know, reasonably popular.
Yes, reasonably popular. I have to say that the fact that my first series died with just one book made me even more grateful at the success that the Anita Blake series had. And then to go on and have another best-selling series with the Mary Gentry series, I mean, I think I'm the only writer I know that had 2 best-selling series going at the same time. There were 2 different roles with 2 different characters.
And now you're about to launch a new series. Your first one in a while. A Terrible Fall of Angels. So we'll switch over to that and use this as an example then of your creative process and all your work. But first, I guess, what can you tell us about it? Without giving away anything you don't want to give away before people have read the books.
Well, it's really hard. I used to be... Anyway, So
I could read what I was given.
Well, I'll try, and if that's not that does not quite do it, you can read what you were given. Every series I do, there is a underlying statement of the world that I know as a writer that isn't always referenced that much on screen in the book. For Zaniel's world, it is that heaven and hell have made a treaty and agreed not to do Armageddon. And the way they've made this treaty, it's public. Everyone knows. It's not a hidden fact. It's this. And there are so many, there are rules about how many demons can come up, how much torment they do, what they can do, and what they can't. And part of the group of people that keep this policed, literally, is the Metaphysical Coordination Unit, also known as the Heaven and Hell Squad. And Detective Zaniel Havelock is a member of that. And he is an angel speaker. He can literally talk to the angels and communicate with them. He was trained as an angel speaker, and he's the only one to ever be fully trained that voluntarily left the College of Angels and went out into the world and did something else. He left after a tragedy that is referred to, but not explicitly. I don't want to give it away. And so the first sentence is, there were angel feathers in the dead woman's bed. He's called to a crime scene where we have a dead college student in their dorm, and we have to solve the crime. And was there an angel? Did she have an angel lover? Were there angels involved? Or was there something else involved, something darker, something demonic? And it is very interesting when you write a mystery in a supernatural world. You have to be very sure that your readers understand your magic system. Mm-hmm. Because my rule is that if I'm going to do a mystery set in a fantastical world, then the magic has to be integral to the mystery. If your mystery could take place in a ordinary world without the magic system, then why is it here? So it has to be integral to the world to have the magic and the mystery. So, but you have to explain the magic system, create the world, make sure you don't cheat your readers and hide a clue, so that when you resolve the mystery, the reader feels like they went, oh yeah, I know exactly how that works.
There would be you have to be careful. I would think also that you don't cheat in that you suddenly pull magic out of the hat to solve something that you haven't set up as being possible using your magic.
Is that's absolutely cheating. I hate that.
Deus ex machina.
Yes. Any reader, any writer that does that in a series, I will never read them again. I'm done. Because I'm sorry, that's one of my bugaboos. No. It's the modern world. That's my specialty. I take the modern world and I add the fantastical to it. Most people say that they take the ordinary and make it fantastic. I take the fantastic and make it ordinary. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to do that, you better make sure that all the reality in your world that people can check you on fact-wise is absolutely as real as you can make it, because the more realistic your base is, the more fantastical thing the reader will believe for you. If you get your everyday facts wrong, then you've lost your reader. But if you do, yes, God out of a machine, if you just pull something out of nowhere to solve your crime, then you've failed. You failed as a mystery writer. You failed as a fantasy writer. You failed as a horror writer. Whatever genre you're mixing, you have failed. And I'm done. So, no. You have to explain your magic system without doing some kind of huge info dump. And then you have to make sure that you do not cheat the reader in any way, that they can help figure it out, that it's all logical when the conclusion comes. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't even like in mysteries without fantasy if they pocket a clue. That drives me nuts. But in what I do in urban fantasy, you better believe you have to It is seriously one of my bugaboos if people cheat and they pull something magical out late in the game that the reader didn't know about. I'm sorry. That means that your plot is weak. Your plot or your world building, one or the other, is weak. You needed to do another draft of that.
Well, what was the seed from which this particular world sprang? Now, that's just a fancy way of saying, where do you get your ideas?
And the real honest answer is, I don't know. Because I was not reading or watching or anything. I'm not an angel aficionado. I haven't been that. It's not been a lifelong thing. With the Anita Blake series, I had always loved monster movies and ghost stories from the earliest I can remember. That made sense. For the Mary Gentry series, my grandmother, when I was bad, wouldn't tell me the boogeyman would get me. She told me that Rawhead and Bloody Bones would get me, which when I went to do research for the Mary series, I realized was a Scottish nursery bogle and from the borderlands of Scotland. So somewhere in my ancestry, and when I took the little DNA test, indeed, I am part Scottish. My background, I thought I knew more about the Fae and stuff from my family background than I did, actually. Doing the research was so much more complex than I thought for the Celtic mythology and Fae. But they sort of made sense. I'd read fairy tales since I was a child, as well as monster movies and ghost stories. For this, out of nowhere, I got the first line and put it on a sticky note. And there were angel feathers in the dead woman's bed, and I thought, huh. So, and I literally remember thinking, well, was an angel her lover? Was it a murderer? Was it, you know? And I didn't know. Around 2014, I would sit down again and start to write. I thought it was a short story. I really did. And when I wrote the chapter out, I realized, I wrote most of the first chapter and I realized, oh my God, it's a book. Not only is it a book, but it's a series. And I was already actively writing the Anita Blake and the Mary Gentry series, and I thought, I cannot do three series at once. I can't. I put it in a file, put it aside, and said, just wait. Just wait. And that year I wrote the ninth Mary Gentry series, The Shipper of Light. And then 2020 came, and I was finally, and I'd been in between buying angel books and doing the research and starting to go, because I've learned my mind usually knows what it's going to do, and I don't question it. It was the only thing I had on my sticky note wall that had angels on it, but it just was such a great first line. I thought, okay, so I began to get books on angels, and I would end up getting books on the lives of the saints, and I've got one called All the People in the Bible from A to Z. I mean, The Key of Solomon the King. I probably have a stack of research books that's taller than my waist now. And so 2020, I sit down to write. And then, of course, we all know what happened in the world. And
I have a vague recollection.
I believe if I had written this book in 2014, when I first sat down and started the first chapter, it would have been a much darker book. But by the time 2020, I was very interrupted. Because I was, writing the Anita story. I was doing short stories. I edited the first anthology that I ever edited with my co-editor, William McCaskey, Fantastic Hope. And so I kept getting interrupted for other things. Interrupted for Sucker Punch, the Anita Blake novel, because we just put it off to editing when the world changed. And my poor editor and managing editor were trapped at home, and we had to edit it in a completely different way. Then it was my idea to write another book, to write more stories, because people said that my stories were helping them get through this. So I wrote Raphael, another Anita Blake novel, is a kind of surprise novel for everybody. And again, interrupted myself with the writing of A Terrible Fall of Angels. But I think I needed the time. I needed to see what was happening in the world, because it helped, really, really impacted this book and made it more hopeful. Because we all need more angels in our lives. right now. We really need to know that the angels are there, that there's angels and hope and people that care. We really needed that. And I think that that's really, really part. I mean, dark things happen. Do not get me wrong. We have a serial killer on our hands. We have demons and possessions and everything. But there are, there's, it's a much more hopeful book than I think it would have been if I'd written it earlier.
What kind of, and this would apply to all your books, but this one in particular, you started with a single line, which is a time-honored, you know, oh, in the hole in the ground lived a hobbit, gave a pretty
yes.
good.
Yes, indeed.
After that. What does your actual planning, outlining process look like? Do you do much, or?
I'm more, you know, I describe it as I am going across a chasm, and I put one board at a time over, and I don't know how to get to the other side. I do it one board at a time across the chasm. I usually have a overarching thing for the mystery, the mystery of who done it, how done it, how it integrates with my magic system, how it integrates. You know, I take my research and then I build on that for my world. So I usually know who done it, how done it, or what done it. But in between, I let the characters tell me what we're going to be doing. It's very organic. If I found in the past that if I outline in detail, that it seems to take away the energy or impetus I had to write. My creative brain feels like if we have a detailed point by point outline, we're done. So I write in order to read what happens next. That's part of the energy of the writing process for me, for the first draft.
What does your actual writing look like? Do you, you know, sit down and work for 8 hours a day in an office, or do you go places to write, or do you write longhand? How do you work?
Oh, no, I don't write longhand.
I haven't met anybody yet who does, but I always ask.
Actually, I know a few people that say they do. I just can't imagine. Not a book, anyway. I usually try to get to my desk early in the morning, because I find that if I do pages in the morning, that I'm more likely to be able to go back to work later in the day and do two sessions. At the beginning of a book, I try to do 2 to 4 pages each session, and I have to have 4 hours, a four-hour block. I've timed this. I really have. So 4 hour block. And if the book is going well, and it's usually the second half of the book when the book has reached momentum, then as soon as I come in, I sit down and I write. It's ready to go. At the beginning of a book, though, I come in and it's 2 hours. I don't do anything. I don't produce anything for 2 hours. I really don't. It's so frustrating. You make tea, you play with the cats, if it's a really stressful day, I started adding meditation before I write, thanks to the last, you know, 16 months. And I sit down once the tea is made, and sometimes what I write is all the reasons I can't write today. I will literally, if the inspiration is not there, I will sit there and go, I'm tired, the room is hot, the room is cold, the neighbor next door is taking down a tree with a chainsaw, you know, all the things that are distracting me. I just write out all the bitching. And somewhere between half a page and 2 pages, usually I get it out of my system and the real writing begins. It's not always good writing, but it is the book, it is the story, and we get going. And anytime I forget that if I sit down and nothing's coming, that typing anything is better than typing nothing, I will have a few days where I get really frustrated, and then I have to remind myself, sit down and write about your frustration. It's almost like, Ray Bradbury said it best, a muse cannot resist a working writer, but they must find you working.
I actually had an interview on here where the neighbor was literally taking down a tree with a chainsaw while we were doing the interview.
So. Oh, my God. I have to say, noise-canceling headphones are a godsend sometimes.
Yeah, I should get some.
Highly recommend it.
You talked a little bit about your not revising as you go and putting in rutabaga or whatever when you reach a point where you have to go back in. So how many drafts would you work through then before you end up with something you would consider submittable?
Well, at the beginning, I would go through two or three, at least three drafts, but and more early on. But as I got better and more practiced, my first drafts were really pretty clean. And for Anita, and then when I had the first draft of Mary, the first book was back to 70% garbage and 30% gold. But I have to admit, I was arrogant when I sat down to write A Terrible Fall of Angels, the first book in this series. I thought, this is my 41st novel. I know how to do this, right? Right. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. I can't cheat my process. For me, creating a world with Anita, I wrote a bunch of short stories and some publishable, some not publishable, and explored the world and the voice of the character that way. So that when I finally sit down, I had some false starts for Guilty Pleasures because I'd never written a series before. But when I finally figured out where I was starting, then I'd already explored the world. Now, first draft was still rough because I'd never done this. This is only the second of my own books I'd ever written, fourth book I'd ever written. But my drafts got cleaner and cleaner. First one of Mary Gentry, I thought, I'll give myself. Sometimes books are harder. When I sat down to write this one, I did not anticipate having as much trouble as I did, but I was back to 70% garbage, 30% gold, because with Anita, I did short stories to explore the world before I sat down. With Mary, I didn't. So the first draft of the novel was my world building and exploration of the character and the character voice. Same thing with Xanil. I had to be really awful. I give myself permission to be really awful on paper before his voice came to me clearly. And once his voice came clear, then the other characters coalesced around him. And that's the thing. I found that for me, once the character's main character's voice is good and solid on paper, other great characters gather to them. That's actually my clue that I've hit it. And so I ate a lot of humble pie because what I've realized now is for me, I either explore and world build in a series of short stories, some publishable, some not, or I just bite the bullet and the first novel is going to take longer and it is going to be very messy because I'm world building and I'm exploring as I go. And my editor and I talked about that and I said, I know this is rough. And, I was very arrogant. I'm sorry. And I usually am pretty clean on stuff. This was so not. And, but because out of that first draft, I actually have the overarching story arc. I know what one of the climaxes of the entire series is going to be. It's just going to be, in some ways, that first draft was almost an outline, which was very interesting for me to understand and know. And as long as I've been doing this, to learn something new about my process and to accept that this is how my process works and that I can't cheat it. This is how it works, and I just have to accept it and work within what works. I think that as a writer, I will try almost anything to see if it works better this way. I have periodically destroyed my entire writing process because I thought there's got to be a better, more efficient way of doing this. No, there's not. It's not an efficient process. It's a messy process because most creative processes are.
Yeah, and every book, no matter how many you do, and I haven't done as many of you as you, but I've done a fair number. Every book is a, there's going to be something in there that surprises you, and it's never just a straightforward process for me. Everything I you always run into problems and situations you have to work your way through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you use beta readers of any sort or any kind of feedback before it goes to agent and or editor?
I really don't. My husband, sometimes, I mean, I'll hand it to my husband, I'll hand it to my assistant, but not really. No, not really. I used to do more of it. I used to do more of it handing it out, but somewhere along the line, I started doing it old school back when I didn't have anybody to hand it to. And I find that if I find for myself that I do not want other people's eyes on it too early. I do not want anybody else's impact on it too early. Because if you're, it depends on the day. All right, I think all writers are like this. On some days you're more secure than others. And if somebody says something on an insecure day, it can deeply impact you much more than it should. My first book, Nightseer, went to an editor, and he said I didn't. He pointed out that I didn't describe any clothing, and since it was set in a medieval world, you know, people weren't wearing jeans and stuff, so I really needed to. But that one comment led me, when I sat down to write Guilty Pleasures, to describe clothing in minute detail, and it's only now, the last little bit, last few books, that I have actually got that out of my head and realized that I only have to describe clothing if it's important. If it's important for the scene, if it's important for the person is and displays their character, I do not have to minutely describe clothing anymore. And it's just very interesting how long that one comment lasted in my subconscious.
Once the novel gets to the editor, what sort of editorial feedback and revisions do you end up doing? Are there things that are fairly consistent that you find yourself working on in that next pass, or or do they
No.
say it's wonderful and you don't have to do anything? That would be nice.
Well, actually, I do pretty clean first drafts most of the time. As I said already, the first book of a new series is not. It is the exception to my rule. But my first drafts are pretty clean. There, every once in a while, though, there'll be a book that Crimson Death was not clean because it really should have been. Excuse me. It really should have been two books. One set in St. Louis, one set in Ireland. But I am a stickler for meeting deadlines, and I am a stickler for delivering what I said I would. I said we'd go to Ireland, and so we would, if I could do it over again, and my editor would have let me do it. I would have made them two separate books, and I would have changed some things. I have so much Irish research I didn't get to use. I have so much. We went to Ireland, and God, that was amazing. I loved Ireland. But most of the time, no, there's not. Excuse me. Every once in a while, I will have a note that she actually hadn't seen anything as rough as this first book for A Terrible Fallen Angels. She says it's given her an insight into my process that she didn't have before. My longtime editor retired early a few years back, so. This is my new editor, and I have only done a few books together. So she's still learning how I work, and I'm still learning how she works. And because of COVID and everything, how she works has changed because couldn't go into the office for so long. But no, there's nothing consistent. I try to make sure that as much as possible, I mean, with rare exceptions, this one I was rough and I knew it. This one had more notes, but I already started fixing it. I didn't wait. This was one of the few times I didn't wait an editorial order because I knew the ending didn't work. I knew the world building didn't work. In this one section, the plot for this book was good, but I had actually done plot that will now go all the way to one of the climaxes of the series. Which now I know that's part of my process. I put that in a file. I know to save it, and we'll get there in a few books. But and I was able to cut the plot here, and she came back, and her fix, one fix I agreed with, and the other fix I was already doing before she suggested it. So she was very relieved. She was very relieved because we're still new together. So she was very relieved that I took editorials very well, and I'd already said, oh yeah, that did not. And So we're still learning. We're still learning how each other does our job.
Well, we're getting into the final few minutes here, so I want to move to the big philosophical questions.
All right.
And they are three. The first one is, why do you write? I mean, you've touched on that, but, and, you know, looking over, you've been doing it for a long time now. Why do you write? The second one is, why do you think anybody writes? Like, why do we tell stories? Why do human beings tell stories? And then the third one is, why do we tell stories of this kind, of these fantastical, with these fantastical elements in them? So there's my three big philosophical questions.
All right. I write because I can't help myself. My family will stamp my card on this, that I get really weird and odd if I don't write and write so many pages. I have to write enough. It is a pressure valve release for me, and it's sort of how I take things and put them through the filter and understand them later. I mean, I've had enough therapy now that I actually know the great philosophical... Wordsworth has a quote that I'm going to butcher, which I apologize for, but it says, some writers take a word out of their overcoat pocket and others take it out of their guts. I'm unfortunately one of the guts. And so I will have some emotional or something that really hits me hard and everything. That's usually the energy behind why I write certain things. And so it's not light for me. It's not a light process. It's how I process hard things. And so I get really weird if I don't have that outlet. Why does anybody write? Why are we storytelling? Storytelling animals, the storytelling animal, that's what somebody's called us. But here's the thing. I think that's incredibly arrogant. We don't know. Whales may be great storytellers. Mm-hmm. We just can't speak to them. And I am incredibly frustrated. Beluga whales in particular have been trying to speak to us, and they've learned how to say some words in English. And the fact that we are not trying to talk whale back to them and learn how to communicate with another sentient species on this planet, I just don't understand that. Why is nobody doing this? And if they are, somebody let me know somewhere online. You know, let me know that you were trying to speak beluga whale. I think we tell stories because it's how we make sense of things. It really is how we process the world around us. We have never been content. If you go back as far as we go, we look at things. We've never been content to see the world as it is without having to add some fantastical element to it. It is who we are. And before modern day, if a stranger came and if they could tell a good story, people would gather around and listen to the stories. You could get, they would feed you and take care of you because you could entertain them and there was no other entertainment. You didn't have radio. Most people didn't even have many books. People couldn't always read. But if you could tell a good story, you could gather around the fire and you could entertain each other. And they've proven that if you have a lesson that is encapsulated in a story, you're more likely to remember it than if it's just told to you as a bare fact. We are designed to remember things in story form.
Why fantastical things?
Because that is what interests my muse. That is what sparks my interest. And it's as simple as that. I think Stephen King was once asked, why do you write what you write? He says, you ask like I have a choice. You act like I have a choice. This is what interests me. And I think that a lot of writers make the mistake, especially lately, of jumping on what's hot. What's the trend? And even if they have success, even if they're selling and they're making a living at it, which is hard enough, they are still not writing the stories that only they could write. They are imitating a trend. They're trying to be popular, but they are not writing what's their heart story, what only they could write. And it always shows, it rings hollow. I have trouble reading it because it's obviously not exactly what they want to be writing. And I really, really wish that writers, especially new ones, would find their own voice as a writer before they worry about trends or what's hot or marketing or anything. And I see so many writers online and they are worrying about things that have nothing to do with the writing process, nothing to do with their story. at the time they're writing it. And I think it really hurts a lot of them. And they don't find the stories that only they could tell. I, as a reader, I am mourning the fact that since they don't find their own ideas, their own voice, that I'm not getting all these great stories that nobody else will come up with. Nobody else will come up with them if you don't. Your muse will be cheated because you've tried to imitate other people's muses because you think it will sell better. And the self-doubt, if you worry about marketing before you've even finished your first book, if you worry about any of that, it hurts you so badly. It clips the rings of your muse. And I wish people would just write the stories that they want to tell and then worry about the rest later. And I know other people hearing this will go, well, but you're lucky. What you want to write is what people want to read. And that's true. There's some wonderful writers that have not had success because they haven't found an audience. And so maybe I am giving this advice from a point of success. But I still know that if I had listened to trends, Guilty Pleasure, the first Anita Blake novel, was rejected over 200 times. And if I had listened to the market and what's popular, I'd have never continued with that series. I'd never had the success I do. If I had listened to everybody tell me I can't do things, that it will never sell, then I wouldn't be where I am today. So I put my money where my mouth is, and it's worked for me because I write what nobody else is writing. Yes, urban fantasy and paranormal, I pioneered that for everybody, and a lot of people have jumped on the bandwagon, but my voice is still unique. My voice and my stories are still unique, even though if imitation is the greatest form of flattery, I've been imitated a lot. But you can always tell the people that have taken that idea and made it their own, and it's still their own story, even if part of the reason they're doing it is they were inspired by me. You can always tell the people that have their own story to tell, like Jim Butcher, Charlene Harris, Patricia Briggs. You can always tell who has their own story to tell and who is just trying to follow the trend.
And what are you working on now with your unique voice?
I am working on the 29th Anita Blake novel.
Wow.
I know, right? Just to be able to say that makes me so happy. And it will be out next year. And then I have been making notes for the 10th Mary Gentry novel, but probably Anita next year. And I would love to get out the second Xaniel Havelock novel. I'd love to get the next book after A Terrible Fall of Angels, but I probably would be setting goals that my little writerly self would have trouble meeting to do it next year and to have two books next year. But ideally, I really feel seriously that when you start a series, you should get the first few books out as quickly as possible.
And where can people follow you along online and keep up with what you're doing?
My website is laurelkhamilton.com.
Two L's on Laurel.
Yes, two L's on Laurel. And thanks to online, it's so funny how things have changed. It used to be you had to contact my editor or my agent to get in touch with me. Now, you know, on Twitter, I am LK Hamilton. On TikTok, I am LKH_official with one L on the end of that. And on Instagram,
official_LK Hamilton.
A voice from beyond.
because I never remember. They're all so close together, and I'm dyslexic, so I switch. I'm very lucky in my dyslexia. It is the middle of a word that switches, not the beginning or the end. That's why I was able to read at 7 and able to figure it out. I just thought I couldn't spell. It's the middle of the word that moves on me and not the beginning and the end. So that's more helpful. If it's the beginning and the end, if the whole word moves, then it's much, much harder. And I'm also on Facebook. I'm not.
Laurel K. Not, Hamilton Official, it says in front of me. So.
Okay, Laurel K. Hamilton Official. Thank you. Thank you very much for that, because I'm just going to.
There'll be links on the webpage for the episode anyway. And that kind of brings us to, and by the way, I mentioned the two L's because my last name is two L's and two T's, and that second T is constantly getting dropped off of Willett.
And it matters when people put it in a search engine.
Yeah. My very first novel from Daw Books, Lost in Translation, when I got the page proofs, the first thing I saw was that they'd left the second T off of my name.
So, oh, no.
Welcome to the big time. they haven't done it since. So.
But no, I get the second L on Laurel left off a lot.
So thanks so much for being on. I enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did too.
I did. Thank you for having me. It's, the only thing that writers like talking about, we all like talking about writing and books. It's kind of what we do.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole point of the podcast. So, so thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
So thanks again to Laurel K. Hamilton for that great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. Just a reminder that the World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com, on Twitter at theworldshapers, and on Facebook at theworldshapers. And yeah, I think that covers it. You can find me online at ewillett, E-W-I-L-L-E-T-T on Twitter. My website is edwardwillett.com. Again, two T's on Willett. And you can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor and on Facebook at edward.willett. You can find Shadowpaw Press, which is publishing the anthology Shapers of Worlds, Volume 2, and published Shapers of Worlds, the first anthology, which I mentioned off the top of the show, at shadowpawpress.com. It's on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press and on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press, which, by the way, is named after our cat, our black Siberian cat, Shadowpaw. And that's about it for this time around. However, I do have a little bit of housekeeping. Again, the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, and we have a sponsor.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus. Savings, checkings, GIC, budget, RESP, RRSP, TFSA, mutual funds, credit score, emergency funds, variable versus fixed rates, compound interest, retirement. The list goes on and on. It's time to make sense of it all. At Kinexus Credit Union, they want to help. Financial literacy is a critical life skill, giving you the knowledge and confidence to make smart, responsible decisions about your money. Visit KinexusMoneyTalk.ca to find expert advice, tips, and solutions for all life stages and events, and increase your financial literacy knowledge and confidence today.
So once again, I'd like to remind you that Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, the anthology, is currently available for pre-order at any online bookstore, pretty much. Certainly on Amazon you can find it, or you can go to books2read2.com/shapersofworlds2, again, numeral 2, which will give you links to lots of different bookstores where it's available. And I hope that you enjoyed this episode of The World Shapers and that you will continue to come back a week, it's not really week after week, bi-weekly after bi-weekly, I guess, every 2 weeks, as I continue to talk to some of the authors who have created so many wonderful adventures for us over the years, so many wonderful characters, and shaped so many wonderful worlds. That's it for this episode of The World Shapers. Thank you for listening. Bye for now.